welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. Mormon Expression, sort of classic edition tonight. You love him? You hate him? He's the most requested, what would we call you, Mike?
Contributor?
Contributor. It's not exactly what I had in mind, but that works. I like it. The terror of Henderson, Mike Tannehill, welcome back to Mormon Expression.
It is good to be here. I missed you.
I've missed you too, Mike. You're a big teddy bear. It's when we get together, it's bear love.
I won't go there.
Mike.
Use the word bear.
Mike, come out of the closet. the anger, the hate, the angst, it's coming from somewhere, Mike.
Is it?
Yeah. It's okay. Some people tell me cocks are yummy.
I'll let you be the judge of that.
All right.
Already.
Depends on the cock.
And on our good friend, Randy. Randy, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be back. I haven't been on since the God is a Psychopath podcast.
they've taken a darker tone, kind of, haven't they?
Yeah. Darker the better.
Darker yet more lighthearted, which is a wonderful thing. We have another wonderful studio audience here tonight. Welcome, guys. Thanks for coming. I think the mics are on. If you feel like you want to contribute, do so. This is old style. I'm sitting here with the headphones on, but we've technologically advanced. In the Mike, you're in Las Vegas. Randy, you're in the Midwest. And
Kansas City.
Yeah, Zion.
Zion, Jackson County.
We're here with the studio audience. In the old days, we always sit here. I had a jack system where we could have like 9 headphones, but now I'm broadcasting it out there. We should bring back the live broadcast. We did that for about 3 or 4 months. They were kind of a pain in the ass, but they were kind of fun. All right, so welcome the two of you. I'm hoping that we bring the magic.
I'll try, but it's just, I've resorted to reading comic books since you stopped challenging me with these podcasts.
Mike, I'm
going to be rusty.
Haven't you been going to Sunday school? Aren't you still a seminary teacher?
I do. I teach seminary.
Okay. So you're not rusty. You're right there in the heart of Zion, pumping away.
I hope so.
All right. Well, tonight, is a podcast that I've had on the list for a long, long, long time. There are many great scholars, very interesting people in Mormon history, people who have been theologians and who have given us lots to think about, who have driven Mormon theology forward. There have been people who have driven social programs, great Mormon pontificators, historians, thinkers. Hugh Nibley is not one of those.
Oh, jeez.
Hugh Nibley is, in my opinion, the most overrated of all the Mormon pseudo-scholars.
Brilliant and wonderful man.
Yes, and his legacy is basically this many, many pages of indecipherable materials that aren't even quoted by people who are in his field. How many times does John Gee quote Hugh Nibley?
How many times has he found inspiration in his writings?
That I don't know.
Did you not have the entire Hugh Nibley collection on your shelf?
I do not. It's voluminous. I have some of them.
What exactly is Hugh Nibley's professional training?
That's a good question. He was
an Army intelligence officer. He had a PhD. It was in ancient history from the University of California at Berkeley.
PhD in ancient history at Cal. That's a pretty good school.
He was no dummy. Okay, I'm exaggerating a little bit. He was not a dummy. But he participated in what he criticized others for.
He spoke 10 languages, I think, and could read like 14.
Supposedly.
Allegedly.
One of the complaints against Nibley. Well, let me take this personal. When I was a student at BYU, I decided to really understand. I'd been taught and schooled since I was in junior high about evolution. So I went and took human evolution classes at BYU. Wonderful classes. Laid the whole thing out. Irrefutable evidence. So a little bit distressed, I wandered into the BYU bookstore, and there was a rack in the corner with Farms pamphlets. And
I remember those racks. Those are great racks.
There was one. I'm just going to let that slide, Mike. There was one there that was by Nibley called Evolution, a Convenient Fiction.
Oh, my God.
Now I am just coming out of reading, you know, the college-level classes on human evolution. And I've just come out of reading all the major works on evolution, doing a survey of the major speakers. And I go through this this talk or whatever it is, and I think it's available online. If you look for it, you can probably find it. And it's a straw man from front to back. Now I'm a believer, and he's quoting like obscure sources translated out of French and whatever else. And it's nothing in there is recognizable to me, having just gone through this course of study. In terms of scholars that he's quoting and supposedly refuting. And the arguments he's using, I mean, as an undergraduate, I can see right through them. I'm not a trained biologist or a trained archaeologist or anthropologist or anything, but I could see right through him. And this is typical of the Nibley sort of thing. There's this old. I was going to look up what it's called. I don't quite know. There's a name for this fallacy. Well, it's an appeal to authority, really. But I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before, that I remember reading as an undergraduate, they talked about this study where there's an inverse correlation oftentimes between this rating of professors and by their students and by their peers, which is if you're teaching an advanced course and no one in your class understands what the hell you're talking about, because you're a professor and because they are a professor and you are a student, you will naturally assume it's because you are dumb and they are so brilliant that you can't figure out what the f*** they're talking about. This is Hugh Nibley. This is why you see him quoted by people who don't understand what he's saying more than you'll see him quoted by his peers, because he tends to have this mix of just nonsense.
Well, here's the role of Hugh Nibley in the church even today. Is Hugh Nibley will tackle a controversy regarding Mormon history with like an 800-page incoherent stream of consciousness, and your fight apologist, you know, a budding apologist who wants to really understand how the church answers these issues will go to Deseret Book and buy that piece of shit, and we'll read about 10 to 15 pages before they can't think anymore. They'll put it on the table and they'll say, you know what? Hugh Nibley covered it. There's 800 pages there.
Yeah, as a collector.
Fine. I don't have to think about it.
As a book collector, Nibley books are great because they're all pristine. None of them have the spine broken.
That's not true.
One of the things that Nibley accused critics of, and this is why I realize I pulled the knives out early here, but this is what he criticized them of proof texting Mormonism, of going through and cutting up Mormonism, pulling quotes out of context, and doing all sorts of stuff like that, which is exactly what he did in his own scholarship. When he would go through and prove the language of the Book of Mormon by quoting from Coptic and Assyrian and Egyptian and just all these varied languages and putting together this straw man of this Reformed Egyptian, they'd be unrecognizable to any scholar in any of those fields. But because he's quoting so many sources from so many languages, and once again, he tended to quote things from French writing and from all this other stuff that you can't even look up, these esoteric sources, there is rumor hushed among scholars that if you take some of the BYU historians and you go get them a little bit drunk on ginger beer, they will tell you that there is a doubt on some of Nibley's sources that they are real.
You can go to the BYU library, which is what he used because he inherited the book collections of all these professors, and they're all there at BYU, and you can look up every book he mentions, and there's tons of notes in the margins of them. They're all right there to go look at anytime you want to.
It could be. But I think Randy's summation is great. A lot of his writing is incoherent. And what I'm telling the reader is it's not you, it's him. because people would say Nibley, when I first got to BYU in 91, Nibley was still teaching. And students would talk about that. They would, with hushed reverence, they would talk about how I went to his class and didn't understand a word he was saying. This is not the mark of a great scholar.
His lectures would start coming down the hall to the classroom, last the entire class, and then continue as he left the room down the hall after the bell rang.
Yeah. Having very marginal social skills and mumbling to yourself and wearing the same sweater for 5 days does not make one great. All right.
You really want to know about Hugh Nibley, Mormon Stories recently did a 3 or 4 part series on his life, and it's very, very good to listen to.
3 or 4 part series, huh? That's odd.
It's fantastic.
That's unusual.
Yeah. I was sad that it ended. It was so good.
Okay. Anyway, all the snarkiness about Hugh Nibley aside, we'll give him credit where credit's due. Tonight, we are going to talk about a particular writing of his that has legs. It surfaces over and over again, and like all great elements like this, it has many versions. But we're going to only look at the original version. It's commonly called the Hugh Nibley Book of Mormon Challenge, or the Hugh Nibley Challenge. And it's actually very short. The Lighthouse, I was looking at different versions, different refutations. The Lighthouse Ministries has one that they refute that obviously has been embellished from the original Nibley writing. And the one that we're going to be looking at was published both in the Prophetic Book of Mormon by Hugh Nibley and in the Collected Works of Hugh Nibley. Which volume here? I have it written somewhere. Collected Works of Hugh Nibley, Volume 8. And it constitutes a couple of paragraphs. Before it appeared in the book, this challenge is supposed to have floated around in Hugh Nibley's classes at BYU for quite a number of years. And when we read the text, it's sort of written towards students. The challenge, basically, in a nutshell, is that Hugh Nibley makes an argument it's actually the same argument that a lot of creationists make, which is irreducible complexity. Nibley makes the argument that the Book of Mormon is beyond the capacity of Joseph Smith to produce. Therefore, it's true. It's an interesting leap on many, many fronts.
Isn't that a non sequitur?
Well, yeah. Well, it's yes, because it doesn't follow. There's no logic to suggest that's true. And if you think about it for a minute, when you run into something in the world that you can't explain, to immediately assume it's inexplicable or that insert your favorite theory here, is a jump. Plus, there's a million possibilities outside of Joseph Smith either having divine inspiration or not having divine inspiration, right? That's a false dilemma.
Well, this is kind of I don't know if condensing or coalescing Hugh Nibley's studies, because he did 4 major works in the Book of Mormon talking about all of the to place it in its context. And so what he's done here is he's taken his 4 novels and how complex the Book of Mormon is and condensed it into this statement. And then he challenges the students with it.
Well, I agree with that. And that's why I like this statement, because it really exposes some of the thinking of Hugh Nibley, some of the reasoning that apologists use, and how they arrive at the conclusions. So we're going to, in traditional Mormon expression dummies format, we're going to go through this word by word and line by line, and let's see what we think Nibley.
Do you want to give it a straight reading first, or just chop it apart?
Let's just chop it apart. If we, with our audience, we give it a reading, they'll all go up and take a pee break and refresh their drinks. I don't want to insult my audience. So I'm looking at Hugh Nibley's Book of Mormon Challenge from the Prophetic Book of Mormon right now. Hugh Nibley once asked his Book of Mormon class at Brigham Young University. So this is the quote. Okay, so first sentence. Since Joseph was younger than most of you.
He's 22.
He was born in 1805. The Book of Mormon was published in 1830. And by Hugh Nibley's own standard, it was written in 1829. That would make Joseph Smith 24.
Oh, 24, that's right.
So in what undergraduate setting are most of the students older than 24? He's leading with a lie.
Missionaries.
Even with return missionaries, an average four-year average college student starts attending college at 18 and graduates roughly at 22. If you tack 2 years for a mission on to that, you have 24. Since Joseph was younger than most of you, this sets the whole –
he wants to evoke into the student's mind that 14-year-old kid wandering into the sacred grove. And yeah, so basically what Hugh Nibley is trying to do here with the students is evoke that idea of Joseph being this really young, 14-year-old kid wandering into the woods to ask God which church to join. And then to kind of transpose that 14-year-old into the author of the Book of Mormon in 1829, to make it seem like even more implausible. Like he's young, he's uneducated, third grade education. There's no way this simpleton could have done this on his own. I think that's what he's going for here.
Absolutely. You have an excellent point, and it's a common trick of the apologists that if you take what they say in totality and knit it together, it's oftentimes incoherent. And what they do is they want to code switch back and forth between Joseph Smith. They want to evoke the 14-year-old kid and ignore what Joseph Smith had accomplished by the time he was 24 or 25. They want to, by this time he's already organized a church and.
Well, not only that, he's been able to get grown men with money to pay him to, search for gold.
Absolutely.
He's been doing this for like a decade.
He shows a massive amount of organizational skills and intelligence by this phase. It's the same way the church says that the Mormon church was organized on April 6th with six members. They had six members sign the register. There were more than six people in that room. And what it does, it gives this evocation of the church goes from nothing to, the 6 billion people, however many they claim today. How many dead people have been baptized now? But it's exactly key. And it threads into what I was saying about Nibley before, where he would take all these little things. He would show you a phoneme, was possible in Reformed Egyptian because it existed in Mesopotamian, in Babylonian languages. Well, that's not, you're meshing two things together. And if you're evoking that Joseph Smith is this country bumpkin kid, well, he's had 10 years on that. And he's had a lot of time pass that allows him to develop himself. We'll get into that more a little bit later. So Randy, I agree completely. Mike? There's that laugh I love. Mike, welcome. Oh, you warm my heart. Mike, really. That you don't know what that does. I just got a warm feeling inside. Like a 9-year-old peeing in the pool. It was like that, but in my heart.
Hey, Mike, are you having a stupor of thought? Did we need an opening prayer before we started?
That'd be nice. You're talking about he hadn't organized the church yet. He got the Book of Mormon and then organized the church.
That's a fallacy. By the time the Book of Mormon was published, the church had been meeting for some time. The Manchester Saints and those guys, we say the church was organized in 1830. That's not exactly true. The church was legally organized, but it had been meeting for several years. And really, if you take Lucy's biography, this idea of the Smith-started religion and their own home-brewed faith had been something that had been around since Joseph Smith was a baby. So there was never a point really where the Smiths, hey, we are Presbyterians and now we're going to become this new thing. It grew organically, bit by bit, step by step. And it's true that they would attend other churches, but these guys were like, kind of slutty for churches. They would go back and forth to different churches. But that doesn't detract from the fact that they were very home-brewed religion. And this is something that Quinn has dealt with extensively and other historians, even Bushman talks about. So the idea that church was suddenly formed in 1830 is crazy. As I will argue here in a little while, the idea that the Book of Mormon was suddenly written in 70 days in 1829 is also a fallacy. And I think his mother really puts the nail in that coffin. Since Joseph was younger than most of you and not nearly so experienced or well-educated as any of you. Okay, so well-educated. So once again, it's not Hugh Nibley if it's not a straw man. Intelligence and education are two different things entirely. That just having an education does not provide that one is capable of creating great things. Homer wrote the Odyssey and never stepped in. As far as I know, he was never either in Cambridge or Harvard. And you know, Plato and Socrates, and there's many, many great authors who have written wonderful, impactful works. And it's not a result of education. Now, Hugh Nibley, being a professional educator, would say this, well educated, that the idea that unless you go to some, you know, East Coast Ivy League school, you're not going to be able to complete something like the Book of Mormon. But I think that that is just, ripe with fallacy. And there's been many great books that have been written by people in Joseph Smith's age bracket. And I would offer somebody to go Google such a thing. And you'll see that there's been many, many great works done by people in their early 20s.
Again, he's just trying to evoke the uneducated farm boy.
Right. Okay. And not as well educated as any of you at the time he copyrighted the Book of Mormon. I don't know that that's true, actually. You know, he was obviously very, very well versed in the Bible. You know, which was a primary source of education for many, many people. We know that Joseph Smith was part of the debating society. We know that Joseph Smith had a library card and he would attend the library. It's not like Joseph Smith just spent his time whittling sticks and milking cows on the Smith farm. The idea that he had no access.
He spent very little time farming from what I understand.
This is 1830. This is not like 12 BC. Okay. And if you read like contemporary authors from that time, you know, from the time frame of Joseph Smith, people like, you know, and I'm stretching it a little bit, but grew up around about the same time, Emily Dickinson and Mark Twain and these people, their works are very accessible and very impactful today. There's people who were able to piece together ideas. They weren't in Mongolia, right? They were in upstate New York. They had access to information. And even all of us today, I dare say everybody in this room can give me entire synopses of books they've never read. They can tell me all about movies they've never seen. They can tell me all about, educational avenues they never pursued.
Isn't that high school? Like book reports and.
Well, that's a great example. I mean, you go to high school, you don't actually read the reading assignment, right? But you absorb it. You listen to the teacher talk. You listen to the other students talk. Oftentimes this stuff boils down. The first time you read Shakespeare, if you read Shakespeare, let's say you're 20, it'll seem very familiar to you because the metaphors and the language and the writing and the stories you've heard over and over and over again. And it's naive to assume that Joseph Smith was in some kind of weird f-ing bubble in which he never got any pop culture handed to him from anybody else.
Well, he was on the frontier of America, but Palmyra shared a library exchange with, was it Manchester was the next town over? That they would exchange books and back and forth to the library in Palmyra. So he had exposure to a nice library
and a
newspaper.
Yeah.
And he would also, you know, he had some social skills. He attended the different preachers that came to town and they'd have big group gatherings. And he wasn't Jethro from the Beverly Hillbillies.
Right. And remember at this time also, I grew up with crappy 70s television. So I spent an inordinate, I am repentant that I spent so many hours watching Gilligan's Island. It really breaks my heart how much time I devoted to Gilligan. He did not have the option to watch Gilligan's Island, right? So these itinerant preachers and people who'd come into town, there would be, not only on a religious basis, there are people who come through and do plays and speeches, and this is a form of entertainment. And you didn't really have anything else to do, so you'd go see these things. I'm saying the opportunity was there to receive much education. Okay, so Nibley continued, not as well educated as any of you at the time he copyrighted the Book of Mormon. It should not be too much to ask you to hand it in by the end of the semester, which will give you more time than he had. A paper of, say, 500 to 600 pages in length. So he's saying, you students who are going to university full time and maybe working have as much time as Joseph Smith had to write the Book of Mormon. How long, Mike, did Joseph Smith have to write the Book of Mormon?
According to this, 63 to 70 days, but I...
Wait. Let's go official church history. When did Joseph Smith get the golden plates?
I'm not good for dates.
1827.
1827. So by the church's own story, Joseph Smith had... And by the church's own story, inside the box were the Urim and Thummim. So he could have dropped that sucker in his hat at any time during those 3 years. So by the church's own story, he had 3 years. So to say 70 working days is purposeful misconstruement. I'll make up another word.
Misconstruction.
Yes. Now,
well, he got him the first time and translated the first 115 pages and then lost it and were taken away. So what's the starting point the day he got them back?
Yes, but this is all conjecture. And according to Lucy, you know, he started talking, and according to Joseph Smith himself, according to his history, when he was 14 years old, so roughly 1819, 10 years before the Book of Mormon was supposedly written, he starts telling the story about these golden plates, about these errant Jews in the New World.
Is it his mom's account when he would tell stories to the family?
His mom said they would sit around the fire and he would tell them all sorts of stories about the ancient inhabitants, the ancient Jews in the New World. And as she said, he would spin these tales as a boy. So when we take the idea, if we assume that there's, I mean, let's take a completely secular point of view and say there's no golden plates. They don't exist. So what do we have by the church's own evidence, by the church's own publishing house? We have the idea that at 14 he claims this thing. He doesn't publish it for another 10 years, but during that time he's always talking about it. He's telling these stories over and over again. And by Lucy's own account, much of like the dream sequence in 1 Nephi matches what Joseph Smith's father was spinning before Joseph Smith was even born. That Joseph Smith's father had the same dreams that are played out and given to Father Lehi. So we know that some of the material, by the account from Joseph Smith and Joseph Smith's closest relatives, predate the receiving of the golden plates or the first vision in 1820.
Well, the idea that the Native Americans were Israelites goes back to George Washington and those guys.
Yes.
I mean, that goes back from the earliest pioneers, pilgrims and things.
Indeed it does.
That doesn't help your case, Mike.
So I would say
it was in the air. So people to make up stories about something that was in the air would be like, you know, me talking about Superman.
Well, it was completely unoriginal at the time. I mean, people nowadays,
if you want to look on the
date, laugh at that idea. So like when I was passing out Book of Mormons back in the early 90s in Arizona, it was like this whole novel idea. People were like, really? Americans from Israel? That's kind of weird. But back then, it was commonplace. Banal. It wasn't
that
exciting.
Because everybody back then, the Bible was a major form of entertainment and study, and today people are watching Gilligan's Island.
I would offer, see what you're saying, okay, Mike, if I understand right, you're saying these things were in the air, so it would be folly for Joseph Smith to make up a story that was based on things that people were talking about, right?
I'm just saying it was understandable that he's talking about these things because everybody's talking about them.
Well, you're a comic book fan. You know, Superman and Wonder Woman and these people, these comics really took steam when they were in the comic books fighting Nazis. Right. That was the golden age of comic books because people had this story, this thing they were trying to deal with, this menace overseas that they couldn't completely emotionally process. So they would have this comic book in which the superhero would be beating up Hitler, and it was a relief because it gave meaning and it gave context to these things.
Correct.
I will cite the strange case of Stephen Glass. Stephen Glass, you can look him up. He was a well-educated author, journalist. I think he was around about 2003, 2004. And what he was doing is he was making up stories. And he was being published in things like Time and New York Times. The thing about his stories were they didn't just make them up out of like raw cloth. Like his stories were all plausible, and they filled in the gaps. This is the same thing that Hoffman said. He would go talk to, by his own account, Hoffman would go talk to collectors and say, "What are you looking for? What's likely to be found?" And then he would take what they asked for and he would give it right back to them. He didn't just go create, he just didn't make things up. He took this feasibility and he looked at inside the gap of that. And then he filled in the gap where people wanted or people assumed. And if you want to really do this sort of thing, you want to be a good liar, you want to tell people what they want to hear. If you're going to debunk people out of money, you're going to start a multi-level marketing in Provo, Utah. You're going to tell people you have this wonderful juice that's out from some island somewhere, and this is going to heal all of your ailments. And then you're going to tell them things about how the pharmaceutical companies are all corrupt and doctors don't know what they're doing, and you're going to play into the zeitgeist of these paranoid people who want a one-step solution. That's the way you're going to make shit up. You're not going to just tell a story. Because in one of these accounts, in the ones in of the Hugh Nibley challenge, I don't know if this is true or not, because he did hand this paper out, supposedly. So there might have been a more embellished version than the one that we're using. But he said, you have to write this about ancient Tibet, because you can't know anything about ancient Tibet. Reading the Book of Mormon as a non-believer, you don't see Jerusalem there. And it's really fabulous that Nibley sees it. I see 19th century America in the Book of Mormon. And it's 19th century theological questions. It's 19th century racism. It's 19th century ideals of a perfect society.
I got Joseph Smith was going to bring pomegranate juice to Palmyra. You know how Adolf Hitler held off the Super Friends during World War II?
No, Mike, I do not.
He used the spear of destiny.
Oh, yes.
The spear that killed his, and that's how he kept them from entering Europe.
The spear of Longinus.
That's it. That's what Hitler had, according to the comic.
Interesting.
So there is a Mormon tie.
So, Mike, did you go look around that website that I gave you on the superheroes?
Which one?
The one on the Hawkeye Project, whatever it's called.
Yeah, I saw that before. Who's the guy that played Wesley?
Wesley Stryker? Who?
Will Wheaton.
Will Wheaton?
Will Wheaton put that on his website a couple weeks ago.
It's amazing how many of those pictures of women are presenting their genitalia. I was amazed at how common a pose that is.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
It's obvious really these artists are not getting laid.
What? Comic book guys?
I know, weird. Huh?
See, when comics started, a lot of the guys were like returned vets from World War II and had a lot of values and stuff. But as time went on, the guys that are now creating the books grew up reading them.
You know, the French have a lot to say about American GI values. Mike, Mike.
The guys creating the books today are man-childs.
Nothing has changed ever, really? Mike. People have been f***ing for 5 million years. They're not going to stop. Nothing's changed. Mike, you know it's true. Search your heart.
But I did enjoy that article.
Thank you, Mike. Don't post any racist shit on my board, please. Can I emphasize that enough? When in doubt, leave it out, Mike.
So he met Oliver Cowdery in April of 1829, and by May they started translating the Book of Mormon.
So, that's a good point. When we look at the transcript of the writing, there are still, if I remember correctly, we still have handwriting on the original transcript of the Book of Mormon from people we don't know who they are, right?
Is that true?
That's true. So we know Lucy, I think, well, we know Emma took a shot at it. Martin Harris helped out for a while. Oliver Cowdery.
David Whitmer.
So the idea that, first of all, just by the church's account, again, and I'm not even going to all these conspiracy theories that are around about Rigdon being involved and other people being involved. I'm just saying, from what we know what the church has published, there were a lot of people who had their hand on this. And we know later, from looking at the method Joseph Smith would interact with the brethren, is they would all be sitting around polishing off a bottle of wine, saying, "Hey, wouldn't it be cool if like God lived on a planet? That'd just be awesome." And then Joseph Smith come back the next day and goes, "Guess what? Yeah, I am not shitting you, but I got a revelation last night. And you know what? It was all the shit we were saying the night before, bros. It's right here." And he would do that over and over and over again. And then they would be like, because then God was confirming what they had already come to. And it was great. Joseph Smith was a magpie.
Oh, wow.
Oh, come on. I've said worse things than that, Mike. Joseph Smith was a magpie. And we know that this is another fun fact of the Book of Mormon. You know, we have the 3,000 copies. They don't all match because Cowdery and Smith would go and change the plates mid-printing. So that not all the pages on the first printing of the Book of Mormon say the same thing. So even when we piece together the original version of the Book of Mormon, we can't even just say this is a first edition, because not all the same first editions. They couldn't stop with that book, and they kept changing it and changing it and changing it. We'll get to Hugh Nibley, and we're going to call flat out bullshit on Nibley in a minute here. But the idea that there's 70 pages and he's not messing with it is just untenable. All right.
So when you talk about the original handwriting, you're talking about the ones that they found in the lead box in the cornerstone of the temple?
Or? Right. There were three copies, from what I understand. And one of the best sources – there were three hand copies of the original transcript of the Book of Mormon, if I remember right. And I'm pulling this out of my head. That could be wrong. There was more than one. There were at least two. And one of them was buried in the lead box in the cornerstone of the Nauvoo Temple, and it was later extracted. It was in the possession of the Reorganized Church for a lot of years. Some of it was water damaged, but it's one of the principal sources.
Her second husband got it, and half of it was water damaged, and he used to use pages of it to start his fire in his house.
That sounds like early Mormon bullshit, Mike.
Yeah, so to sum up, Hugh Nibley's asking his students in 3 months to produce something that Joseph Smith took at least 3 years to put together,
and more likely 10. Right. Let's be realistic. Let's if we're going to look at it as a believer, because that's the challenge. He's begging the question. He's saying you can't do this because he did it in a miraculous way. But we have to say, well, let's actually take the challenge and use everything at our disposal. And if we're using everything at our disposal, that means we have time. We have 10 years. We have 10 years between 1820 and 1830.
But you got 3 months, kids.
But you guys have 3 months, and you're not going to be able to drop out of any other classes.
So are you saying that while he was translating with Oliver, he had the notes he'd taken and stuffed them in his hat, and he was reading them off to Oliver?
Are you asking for my theory of how he produced it?
Well, when Oliver shows up is when he starts transcribing.
Look, it's clear that half of the Book of Mormon is a stream of conscious piece of shit. So the idea that he's just sitting on the stoop just talking about whatever pops into his head is not a scary thought to me. Joseph Smith.
Like something like, Nibley talks about the first 40 pages, and he put it in the book, The Lehi in the Desert.
Yeah.
And talks about how accurate that was to the culture and time.
Oh, my God, Mike.
The form comes from.
Mike, you want to know the best example of how bad literature the Book of Mormon is, if you're talking about the first 40 pages? The Book of Mormon movie. That epic piece of shit showed exactly how two-dimensional and stilted and uninteresting and uncompelling that story is. It is god-awful literature.
So okay. Let's go to the next paragraph, because we're going to get to all these points. Great points. So Nibley goes on. Call it a sacred book if you will. This is the assignment. and give it the form of a history. Well, the Book of Mormon, the form of a history, all right. Well, okay. 300 is the form of a history, right?
Right. Lord of the Rings.
That's Lord of the Rings, yes. Okay. Tell of a community of wandering Jews in ancient times. Have all sorts of characters in your story and involve them in all sorts of public and private vicissitudes. Give them names, hundreds of them. Pretend that they are real Hebrew and Egyptian names circa 600 BC. Be lavish with culture and technical details, manners, customs, arts, and industry, politics, and religious institutions, rights, and traditions. Include long and complicated military and economic history. Let's stop and let's go back into these. So he's putting down this assumption of what the Book of Mormon has and says, your book, dear student, you're going to write has to have them. Okay. So, wandering Jews.
That's original.
Well, what he's getting at is you have to have cultural names and habits and the things they talk about and do.
Wait. Stop. Let's pretend that Joseph Smith only ever read one book. Let's just take away all that library stuff. Let's pretend he only had one book.
The Bible?
Yeah, what book would we think that would be? What is the Bible? Well, my God, it's a story of Jews that are wandering around in Palestine that's full of all sorts of names and culture and customs and manners and arts and industries and politics and religion and institution and rights and traditions. That it's the f***ing Bible that he's talking about right there, right? So what's funny here is Nibley, first of all, he assumes that it's a 14-year-old kid. Now he's assuming that he's never read the Bible. Because what would we assume if Joseph Smith were plagiarizing this? If Joseph Smith were just writing it? We assume that like I was talking about before, that if he was going to create a lie, he would not create it out of thin air. He would jam that lie into crevices of what people already know and assume. So, for example, if Joseph Smith did, in fact, write the Book of Mormon, it wasn't history, what we would assume to find, what we'd expect to find in there is 19th century ideas wrapped in biblical language. Do we find those? My God, yes, we do. Many of them.
Yeah. So
that's what we would expect if it was written. If it was not written by Joseph Smith, it was translated, what we'd expect is all these things in there that didn't show up in the Bible but would be indigenous to the people of the New World. Do we find those? No, not really.
We don't find anything similar to Mayan culture.
Why would you want Mayans?
Because they're the ones that actually lived in the New World.
For example, yeah. okay. Public, hundreds of names. I mean, we've already mentioned the Lord of the Rings. But you know, here's somebody who liked to play around with language, J.R. Tolkien. And he not only made up names, and he did this in his spare time, this book. He was a college professor. He lived through two wars during this time. There was a lot of stuff going on. He did this sort of in as a spare time hobby. Made up entire languages, hundreds of names, all these things. Just saying, it's been done. This sort of thing has been done before. And when you see the linguistic breakdown of the names in the Book of Mormon, they follow a particular pattern. And most of them, or a great deal of them, can be tied to very similar names with extra syllables thrown in to names that are in the Bible if they're not just straight from the Bible.
Yeah, there's basically like two dozen names in the Book of Mormon, and then he takes that two dozen, turns them into hundreds by Gid-Gadoni, Gid-Gadona, Gad-Gid-Gid-Gad-Gid-Don, you know.
Which follows patterns in the Bible. If you look at some names, there are names in the Bible where that happens, where it's the same name that has a ha on the end. And you know, Nibley and these guys get a big hard on for the fact that there's like Egyptian roots of words in there, forgetting that the Bible itself has like this Egyptian stuff in there. It's like, holy cow, how does this 14-year-old kid in upper state New York know anything about Egyptian culture? Well, he probably read the Book of Genesis. That's how he knew about the Egyptian culture. I'm sorry. I really have a potty mouth lately. Mike, do you forgive me?
I can't forgive you. You can pray about it.
No, I want your forgiveness. I don't care about your fucking God. I want your forgiveness.
Do you watch rated R movies, Mike?
Sometimes.
Oh, okay.
Oh, you're not a... You don't get... You just don't get it, Mike.
Okay. Pretend that they are real Hebrew and Egyptian names of circa 600 BC. And I think pretend is a great word that Nibley uses. Because oftentimes he'll find these names, Ha, which sort of, that's an Egyptian root. And if they find a name that lines up, then it's proof positive. If they find a name that's never been found in any Egyptian script, well, then it's Reformed Egyptian. It's Egyptian that has been modified over time. These guys can't lose because if it matches, then bang, you got a hit. If it only kind of matches, bang, you got a hit. If it doesn't match, well, that's clear evidence. If it doesn't match, that Joseph Smith couldn't have made it up, right? Because if he got it out of the Bible, well, that shows it's has the same roots. If it's not in the Bible, well, a 16-year-old, a 14-year-old kid can't make that up. And, you know, this is the proof of pseudo, this is a pure example of pseudoscience where all cases prove that you're correct.
Unfalsifiable. Sorry, unfalsifiable.
Unfalsifiable is the word I'm looking for. Thank you. Okay, lavish with cultural and technical details. The Book of Mormon, and Randy, you were hitting at this, is not lavish with details, and that's one of the reasons it's so flat. It's so one-dimensional. And when they put details in, like the fact that with no tools, they go start smelting hammers first and build an entire fucking boat. This just, no, you couldn't even do that today if you had a Home Depot next to you.
Who says they had nothing when they got to the
Nephi says that. He said they had to go smelt iron to even start with the shipbuilding tools.
Yeah, he didn't have any tools.
They brought things with them.
From Jerusalem, the inland capital of they had all these shipbuilding tools.
Yeah, okay, Mike, they brought one f***ing bow, and it broke, and all hell broke loose. I don't think that they were really packed down with all kinds of great tools.
It lost its spring.
It lost its spring. Yes, it did.
His brothers had bows, but he had the good one.
They had the steel one, which... There's so many steel bows in ancient Israel.
Yeah, steel bows circa 600 BC. All those, you know, that they got down at the Sportsman Warehouse. Okay.
Steel in those days?
Steel? In 600 BC? Wait, yes, are we talking about the metal? There's a reason they call it the Bronze Age.
Move on.
Mike?
Yeah, it's called the Bronze Age.
Okay, all right. So they did have iron. I will glance that, but being able to do a coke furnace and smelt iron into steel is a little bit off before this time.
Egyptians and Hittites have been doing it since 1500 BC. They were blending iron with other metals 800 years before the Jaredites.
Did you read that in Apologist book?
All right. We'll leave that one on the side of the road for a while. I'll give it to you as a win. All right, there's steel in the Book of Mormon. Great. All right. Be lavish with culture and technical details, manners and customs, arts and industries. So the manners and customs, I mean, this is the thing in particular where I hinted at, like the court, is it Korahor that goes into the courts? How in the f***ing world did the New World people get English common law going? You know, we're talking about rites and traditions. The courts that they describe, the judge system, has nothing to do with anything in the Bible. It's really based on like Roman influence into English common law and this American sense of identity and individualism and law and this stuff shows up. So when you say rites and traditions, I mean what's Nibley talking about here?
Yeah, Korihor. When Korihor goes about preaching nihilism and atheism, which also is anachronistic. It says very explicitly in Alma chapter 30 about the freedom of speech. Like they could not arrest him because you know he had freedom of speech. You could not they could not say what you had to believe. That's not something that you would see around 100, 120 BC in any culture.
I blasphemed your God earlier, I want to point out. Okay.
Is the Hennessy talking?
I've had just a Utah beer.
Oh?
No, that's all I got in me. I'll have another. Thank you, sir. Okay, so we talked about rites and tradition. I mean, if you can draw on anything anywhere, and this, again, is my complaint about if you came up with anything even remotely, like within a F-16 flight from Jerusalem, Nibley's going to give you credit for it, and that's a pretty wide target to hit. So we talked about military and economic histories. He has the great battle end with the two kings like squaring off with swords. Like, when has that ever happened? Ever?
How about a battle in which all 2,000 soldiers survive, and the enemy is thoroughly, soundly defeated? That's like a story out of a comic book.
I read a couple years ago that prior to the invention of the machine gun, the average battle lasted less than. Mike, we're making fun of the military stuff, and I just mentioned the two kings squaring off. So Mike, I have a question for you. I read this in a book. Prior to the invention of the machine gun, the average battle lasted how long?
Oh, days, wasn't it?
Less than 2 minutes.
When the two armies would clash together and swing swords at each
other? Two armies would clash together, swing swords, people would die, and everybody else would run away.
2 minutes, really?
So the idea, like in the Book of Mormon, there's ideas of fighting to the last man and right. like fighting, the kings swishing swords at each other and people without heads lifting themselves up to take a last gasp of air. things like that.
Oh, it's shiz.
I think maybe the Nibley challenge kind of holds if you're not bound by the rules of like reality, you don't have to describe warfare like that would be in the New World. You can have chariots and horses and I've made this argument before that the numbers that are given in the last battle in New York, you remember when we were trying to invade Iraq in 2000 in 1991,
and we went up to the Red Army, and they'd run away.
These photos of the supply chains, and they would have these tanks, and they would just have trucks just driving up and down the line over and over again, just trying to fill these things up. The problem that Napoleon and every other invader has had is logistically, you can't get that many people in one place, and these guys have single commanders commanding 10,000 people, which is more than King Henry V commanded when they invaded Normandy. So you're talking about complete implausibility, and Nibley's giving them a win for this. So Smith's not bound by any sense of reality.
I, when I was on my mission in the Book of Mormon, the actual Book of Mormon in the Book of Mormon, there's that great battle. I counted out all the dead soldiers, and it was over 300. It was about 320,000 people died in the last battle. 320,000 people in one battle. How many died at what was that Civil War battle?
Gettysburg.
Gettysburg. A little bit over 50,000 in 2 or 3 days.
This battle, 320,000 people died, and we can't find their bones.
And if you go anywhere near Gettysburg, there's signs up all over that say, you can't remove anything, right? You can still go out into places where there are battles in the South and find bullets. They found evidence of one of the early expeditionary teams that was in Florida in the 16th century. We're finding in bogs and swamps like hilts and things from swords in the Middle Ages. The idea that this many people using steel, not just iron and bronze, using steel weaponry and chest plates and head plates and face plates and all the other stuff they had, that all of this just disappears, that all this iron oxidizes and woof, it's gone. All right, so I'm staring at the word plausible in front of me. That's why I'm hammering this point. Observe the appropriate literary conventions. Explain the derivation and transmission of your varied historical materials. The Book of Mormon literary conventions. I don't know, does that even merit talking about?
No.
Okay.
It's so bad it doesn't merit discussion.
And you know what's funny is he mentions here later on that they always use the first edition. The first edition is full of yokel grammar and okay. Above all, do not ever contradict yourself. For now we come to the really hard part of this little assignment. You and I know that you are just making this all up. We have our little joke. But just the same, you are going to be required to have your paper published when you finish it, not as fiction or romance, but as a true history.
Bullshit! Come on! All you had to do in Frontier America in 1830 was slap $3,000 of Martin Harris's hard-earned money to get a book published. You can't get a book published as history today just by throwing money down?
Indeed.
This is a different world.
Yeah, it's not. Well, you can. I mean, you can do exactly what Joseph Smith did. You can go down to a Provo publisher and self-publish a book. And if you want to fund your 3,000 copies and have your friends go hand it out, you can do that today. It's not like Bantam Books picked this thing up in 1830. You know, you couldn't find a copy of it in the Harvard bookstore.
I don't think that's what he's implying. I think he's saying you've got to have it legitimately published, not just...
Well, he didn't. Smith didn't have it legit. I mean, that's the point you're making. It wasn't legitimately published.
But yeah. For this assignment, I think he's saying you got to get a publisher.
Okay.
Sign on to this.
Yes, you're right.
I may be reading in too much.
No, he's saying just present it as a true history.
But
when people read it, they're going to judge it.
Well, he's saying you need to get it published, not as fiction or romance, but as history. If you're just getting it, if you're just paying someone to bind paper with your words, that's not getting it published, not as a romance or as fiction, but as an actual history.
Understand that it's going to be criticized because you're presenting it as history and you're opening it for criticism.
Okay.
All right. So being criticized is a requisite of it being real? I mean, I don't see how that helps the case one way or the other. So if we go back to what we're doing, Nibley here is saying, here's what you have to do that Joseph Smith did. And if he's just arguing that your book gets criticized, well, I can write plenty of things that are going to get criticized. That doesn't speak to the fact that they're more true.
Just make it bad enough.
Yeah. That says nothing about quality one way or the other, you know. Okay. After you've handed it in, you may...
I think we've already addressed this next line.
You may make no changes in it. All right. The Book of Mormon is, has, and always will be a moving target. They have never stopped with that book. They are changing things even today.
What major change? Name a major change.
Wayne Delightsome to Pure and Delightsome. That was pretty key, given 1978.
Yep. When they took out the Trinity. The Trinity was a huge one.
The Son of.
Yeah. Behold God to changing Behold the Son of God. That's not a slip of the tongue. So
why would they need to change it in the last 50 years? You know, if they've taken out all the grammar.
Exactly. If it's the most correct book. Look, in the very first edition of the Book of Mormon, and this is why Nibley knew this. King Benjamin shows up after he dies in that book. They fix that, right? But he was dead and he shows up later in the book.
Resurrection.
There were problems in this book. The grammar is atrocious. It's laughable to say that it hasn't been changed.
Benjamin can't get resurrected. He was before Christ. Right, Mike?
Correct.
Translated like Moses then.
This is where Nibley is smart enough that he can't get a pass on this. He's flat out lying. And since he's talking to undergraduates, he's flat out deceiving them. Okay, what is more, you are to invite any and all scholars to read and criticize work freely, explain to them that it is a sacred book on par with the Bible. That's been done, and they all, to a person, dismiss the book.
Yes, it has been, there was a video with, who's the lead singer of The Killers?
Brandon Flowers.
That meets Richard Dawkins.
Yeah.
Gets blindsided. And Brandon Flowers says, the book has been, and this is your typical, he was standing in for your typical TBM who's confronted with that exact same question. Joseph Smith was a fraud. He was an obvious fraud. The Book of Mormon is obviously 19th century fiction. And he said, and Brandon Flowers' answer was, look, the book has been torn apart by scholars and it has stood up.
We keep printing it, so it's stood up.
It's still in print. Yeah, torn it apart, and it lays all over the ground in pieces. But guys like Hugh Nibley are the scholars he's talking about, pseudo-scholars, all of them with an agenda. So the book has not stood up to scrutiny at all. And multiple fields have converged to prove that it's not true.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say here, I'm going to reverse the Nibley challenge. Because I'm going to say it's actually quite amazing to me how many things Joseph Smith got wrong in the book. Because in my mind, just about everything where he makes an assertion about reality, they're all wrong. If he insists that they had machinery, if he insists that they had chariots, if he insists they had steel, if he talks about population growth, the number of people who die, how horticulture, what sort of making wine, getting people drunk in the New World, how you navigate the seas. I mean, just about any time that book touches the real world, it gets it wrong. I can't think of anything in the book that you would say, oh, well, I will give him that.
What about when you follow the directions Lehi took and it takes you to the one spot he could have built a boat?
Joseph Smith had a f***ing map, right? I mean, he had a map of the world.
What map shows that point with the trees and the graveyard and everything that was there?
How do you know, Mike, that there is only one point in which a fictitious voyage can be launched? I mean, you're begging the question again. You say there's one point. What's your proof for the fact there's one point for this boat that doesn't exist to be able to be launched to the New World? That's the thing I love about believers is they say these things. Well, it's the one place in the world where you could launch this boat. What boat are you talking about? World. It's all
the only place.
Yeah.
You can't explain that.
Right. Yeah. We know that Middle Earth is real because Finland is the only place where you could get the silver that you'd be able to build elven armor. It's like, what are you talking about? Nothing you said in there is real. None of that makes sense. You know.
Yeah. They love farms loves their bullseyes. So they found a place somewhere near Jerusalem that has a valley and a little river.
Yeah.
Wow. You found a valley and a little river.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there's
Yeah, Mike, you're back now. Go ahead, Randy. Oh.
So you got this gigantic peninsula of Saudi Arabia. What are the odds that there's going to be one patch of land that at least one patch of land that has a temperate climate and lavish foliage and whatnot. Mike, this is what when you're referring to psychics, this is what's called a high probability hit. Okay, so I'm willing to concede Joseph got lucky, but it was a pretty high probability hit.
Well, I don't even think it's that lucky because the directionality given in the Book of Mormon is vague. So what the apologists have done, they scanned the map and, like you said, find a probable space. And this is a space that Mike's saying, oh, here's where you could launch this voyage. But they're begging the question. They found a valley and they assume that Lehi was there. But there's no proof at all that Lehi was there.
And if let's say all of Saudi Arabia was barren wasteland to the beach in every direction, they would have changed the narrative that he went launched off from a different place, maybe from Egypt, you know, maybe from somewhere towards Greece, or I don't know. I actually need a map in front of me.
Well, then they find that the graveyard in that place matches.
Yes, Nahum. Yes, that's
Mike.
Big bolt
that I can guarantee you, beyond a shadow of a doubt. With every fiber of my being, you can go to the island of Manhattan and find a large cemetery, and you can find a gravestone that will tell you that I, John Larson, died at least 100 years ago. It'll be engraved. That. It'll say in fucking stone, Mike. It'll say John Larson died 1874. Prove that wrong, MF-er. The fact that you have a two-syllable word of fairly easy to pronounce phonemes, Lehi, that show up in a city what's the radius of miles we're looking for? Where would it have had to have shown up for Nibley to say, oh, that's just too far away. That couldn't be it. We're talking about tens of thousands of square miles. And they find one rock that has a saying, Nahum or whatever it is.
It doesn't even say Nahum. It says NHM. There's no vowel.
So you don't even have vowels. What is just the raw probability of this, that within 10,000 miles you find an inscription that matches?
Don't know.
It's not insignificantly small. And if that's the only – even if it said Lehi was here in Nahum in 600 B.C., Nephi fucking rocks, and it had that sitting there, that's still not proof that the Book of Mormon – I still wouldn't believe it because there's no slag in the New World. Okay,
look up for me Mina Primavera in Peru.
What? Why? Just tell me. Just pretend I'm not sitting in front of a computer.
Not going to look it up.
It's a 1,400-year-old mine where they dug out 3,710 metric tons of iron, and they have a forge where they forged iron in Peru, and it matches the time period.
So, I mean, there's a lot of things we have to get into there, and
this is what apologists do, okay? They have their conclusion, and they work backwards and cherry-pick, and we're talking Book of Mormon apologists. They're not cherry-picking like a lot of fruit. They're cherry picking little gnats here and there.
Well,
ignoring the gigantic volume of contradictory evidence. You're doing it wrong. That's not how you get to truth.
I you know, this is very similar. There's these a lot of wackos in the state of Utah that are looking for this Spanish gold, right? And they can tell you all sorts of stories like you said. But they forget one simple thing. People do not put gold in a mine. They take it the f*** out. Like, you don't store gold in a mine. If you're looking in holes to find Spanish gold, you're looking in the wrong place. And so you look at this mine and you say, okay, well, where is all the steel? Where is all the iron? Where is all the slag? Where is the coke? Where are the furnaces? Where are the axles? Where's the axle grease? Where's the bridles? Where are the horse farms? Where are the horse bones? Where are the bronze breastplates? Where these things don't just disappear. And matter of fact, what happens is they get melted down and repounded out, and then the society gets more and more and more of this stuff. It doesn't just disappear. It stays there because it's too valuable. If your grandpa had a steel breastplate, you don't throw it in the ocean. You keep repurposing that thing. You beat it into a plowshare. All right. Well, let's get back on track. All right, we're coming near the end. I promise, and I have no idea how long this podcast actually is. It might just be a little short one.
You want me to read the last paragraph here?
Sure. Can you do that for me?
If they seem over skeptical, you might tell them that you translated the book from original records by the aid of the Urim and Thummim. They will love that. Further, to allay their misgivings, you might tell them that the original manuscript is on golden plates, and that you got the plates from an angel. Now go to work and good luck.
Yeah, I could do this. I have no doubt. As a matter of fact, every so often on the internet, people will start barbing back and forth in Book of Mormon language. It's not that hard to do, and there have been plenty of nutcases who have actually done this.
Who's the guy you did an interview with?
You're talking about the guy I didn't do an interview with and won't do an interview with, Nemelka?
The one that wrote the book of Nahor or something like that?
Yeah, there's plenty of this stuff. If you look online, you'll find four or five different copies of the sealed portion of the Book of Mormon. And it reads just like Joseph Smith's shit. It's people have done this over and over again. Who is the king of Beaver Island? What's his name? This Jesse Strang.
We all want to be that guy.
He had a fabulous hat.
Yeah, yes. Well, to be a pimp, you got to have a hat.
I mean, he wrote a book. Nutcases writing manifestos in little huts in the wood is not like a marker of genius, Mr. Nibley. And the fact that they're incoherent or that they're complicated, you know, that seems to be one of Nibley's arguments, is this thing's complicated. But the complexity is, no, every manifesto is complicated, you know, because it's the inner workings of a deranged mind or whatever. But the Book of Mormon is not that complicated. Characters are one-dimensional. The storyline is flat. People, it's not a compelling piece of literature.
Now, in any given part of the Book of Mormon, there is only just a handful of characters that are being described. It's really there's a lot more complexity character-wise in the
That's
Lord of the Rings.
Following the gospel, you follow a family line, which is what the Book of Mormon does.
Abraham.
It stays with a blood mark.
Could we say that possibly that's
what the Bible does following the Israelites?
Like it's, could we say it's Abrahamic? Mike?
Talked about
in the Book of Mormon is that it stands up to what the gospel is and what the gospel's about. And when you get into
so all major characters in the scriptures come from families, right? Like Paul, for example.
Well, like Christ.
Well, like Paul, for example.
Well, yeah. Well, I don't remember what family he's from.
He's not from any family. That's my point, Mike. Your theory doesn't make any sense.
He was a Jew, wasn't he?
Oh, you got me there. He was, in fact, a Jew, Mike.
Abraham's family.
Mike, I love what you do to me. You have a way. Mike, you stroke my soul.
You've got to look at the teachings of the Book of Mormon and how they just fit perfectly into everything the Bible was about and explains the Bible.
Funny, huh?
No.
Right? You have this book that is protected.
It explains the...
Yeah. Go ahead, Randy.
You guys have been cutting out, so I'm thinking I'm cutting out. Am I cutting out?
No, I can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. The thing about the Book of Mormon, and it's actually on a book by Bob Price. I can't remember the name of it, but I think we did a podcast on a Mormon expression. He basically outlines all of the theological controversies of early 19th century upstate New York. And he said the Book of Mormon is like the answer to all of those. All it's doing is addressing 19th century doctrine. And it's not consistent with later Mormon theology. It's when Abinadi was preaching before King Noah, he's preaching the Trinity, like explicitly Trinitarian doctrine. Well, guess what? There is no Trinity in the Bible. That was something that was an innovation later on, hundreds of years later,
right?
When they had to reconcile the fact that Jesus was their God, but then so is...
Yeah, I agree. So I think all in all, I mean, to sum up here, and I think you guys are going to be quiet because I think you're all done, but I'm just going to finish it out. I think for Nibley here, he's setting up this, like I said in the beginning, this straw man that saying, okay, write this book and it has to be true is what he's saying. It has to have all these elements that make it true. But as we've gone through these elements one by one, we see that the Book of Mormon doesn't really hit that. What the Book of Mormon does is for a believer, they see this as the mark, and then they go and sort through the evidence and say, oh, we know that Reformed Egyptian is a real language because it says so in the Book of Mormon. And if we find anything in the, you know, Mesopotamian language or in Coptic or in Egyptian, then that's proof that it's there. But there's no outside scholarly evidence at all that there is any such language. So Nibley's assumption on that front is from an outside scholarly point of view, unverifiable and untenable. He would have to first establish that Reformed Egyptian exists. So if an outside scholar, not connected with the Book of Mormon, goes through and says, you know what, guys? I know it's really f***ing weird. The Mayan, even though they didn't use any iron or steel anywhere in their society, they actually mined a shitload of that stuff out of the ground and smelted it. If somebody else who's not a Mormon is saying that thing, that's interesting. But when it's a Mormon going back and looking and saying, what's there? I remember there was a copy of the Book of Mormon that was distributed, I think about 81 paperback, where they had pictures of like this hole in the ground. And they said, could this be a baptismal font? So when you take a point of view and you assume that it's what you already want it to be, then it's easy to make that. So if you assume that Joseph Smith did all these things, it's easy to make this challenge. And Nibley is, of course, also being disingenuous in not acknowledging the number of sacred texts that have been written by uneducated people or people without degrees or people who have come up with all sorts of great books in Hindu tradition and Buddhist tradition, and in the Middle East, there's tons and tons of writings. There's sutras and pseudo figure or whatever it is. There's a lot of outside the Bible writings that have been done by people who have no degrees. And Nibley is fully aware of this, and not just giving Joseph Smith credit as doing this again seems very strange and disingenuous. Randy, any more thoughts?
No, it's not true. It's so falsifiably not true. In order to accept the Book of Mormon as a historical document, you have to accept the Tower of Babel as a historical event. And any linguist worth his weight in salt knows that it's untenable and complete unmitigated bullshit.
Absolutely. And every BYU, I'll tell you this as a former student, every BYU linguist down there, no matter how much they believe, will tell you the same thing.
And for the Tower of Babel to be historical, guess what else has to be historical? The flood. The fucking flood. A cartoon story for kids. So implausible. So ridiculous that, you know, that no, and Mormonism cannot untie themselves from this, because Joseph Smith, right down the road from where I fucking live, said the Garden of Eden is here. Well, then how the hell did the Cradle of Civilization get to the Fertile Crescent? They had to have a boat, a flood, and then land over there. Right, Mike?
Correct.
Oh, my
and,
God.
And Christ himself testified of the flood.
Yes. No, no, Mike, you're absolutely right. That's what Randy's saying.
He testified of Noah.
To believe in Mormonism, you have to believe, and DNC 77, you have to believe the world is 6,000 years old. You have to believe in polygamy. You have to believe in the flood, and you have to believe in the Tower of Babel. Those are inescapable. And you have to believe in no death before the fall. Right, Mike?
6,000 years, give or take.
Give or take. 6,000 years, give or take. No death before the fall. The flood, the tower, it's all gospel truth, right, Mike?
You're rejecting so much science. Good stuff. I mean, the stars that you look up in the sky, that light that you're seeing, Mike, is millions and millions of years old, maybe hundreds of millions of years old. How could the Earth be 6,000 years old? And the universe. You're saying the whole universe is 6,000 years old.
No, this don't is, go that crazy.
Randy, well, come on.
That's nuts.
Am I even evangelical?
This is patterned after the world in which we used to live. Come on. Come on.
That's right. Wait, if they're all in the same universe?
Well, yeah. You know, when the stars are falling in the end, those aren't stars falling. That's this f***ing planet moving back to Kolob, man.
Okay. Oh, jeez. Jeez, I really f***ed that one up. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah. No,
the 6,000 thing, years thing is
DNC 77.
It's to Adam.
The oh, okay. Age of
the so Earth, what about the hominids? What about the Neanderthals?
The Earth is an unknown, or we don't know exactly how old the Earth is.
Yeah, we do. The Mormons don't. Adam. Mormon prophets don't know how old everybody else who goes to like junior high school knows how old the world is. When you say we don't know, let's be clear about who we're talking about. We're talking about the priesthood. What's become very clear is if the church is true, getting ordained to high office is like getting a lobotomy, because things that are clear to the rest of the world, like remember the Civil War? That we the rest of the country said, yeah, slavery's not really a good idea. The Mormons were behind on that, and it took until like last Tuesday for them to actually acknowledge that. So like the one thing we know is like every idea that we've had to backtrack, it's not like people at the time didn't know this was a bad idea. Right?
No, the curse wasn't the skin of darkness. That's been made clear. The curse was actually the descendants of Cain were made into the Neanderthals. And the curse was they had, you know, smaller brain, sloped forehead, dragging their knuckles, clean their butt with their tongue like a cat. It's just, that's the real curse.
Oh, okay. I get it.
Did they remove the bottom ribs when they were cursed?
Did they what?
Take out the bottom ribs when they were cursed?
What are you talking about, Mike?
Two Eves per man.
So that's amazing.
So Nibley, this challenge has been met many times over. The challenge is baloney, and you knew it. It's you have lies in there that you flat out knew, and this is one of those things that people repeat without ever really thinking about it. It holds no merit. Mike, I'll give you the last words.
What?
The Book of Mormon fails the Nibley challenge.
It does indeed. I think you summed it up brilliantly. That's kind of the point we've been making.
There?
Wow, that was.
Yeah, Mike.
Okay,
last word.
When the Lehites arrived, there were other people there in the land. They weren't the only ones there.
The Neanderthals, is that?
Now, one of the things that came out in National Geographic in November, this is on November 20th, was that nearly one-third of Native American genes come from West European people linked to the Middle East and Europe. So they have the DNA now.
Yes, Mike. And okay, since you're quoting it, in what year did they make the trek across the land bridge to get that European genetic material? You quoted the f***ing study. You tell me what year.
Siberia.
I'll give you a hint. It's around 45,000 years ago. So you can't just pull half science stuff out of your ass and pretend it helps your story. It doesn't. Unbeknownst to all of you listening, we've had a lot of call troubles tonight because Lindsay's an amazing editor and has covered most of that up. But I think we've lost Mike for the last time, and I feel bad. I always feel bad after I have Mike on here and I yell at him. I apologize to Mike. I'll buy him a beer or something. So
I know you said Mike gets last word, but I would like to close my comments with a quote from the Creation Museum. Science, like how they say that.
My wife was thinking she hasn't seen a beating this bad since someone stuck a banana down Mike's pants and turned a monkey loose.
So hey, next time, can we get three cans and some string? And
you got to come up here to the studio, man. So you heard my 45,000 year rant?
17,000 years was the age of the bones they studied.
The bones that were descendant from the land bridge migration. The land bridge migration happened long before you believe Adam walked the earth.
They made a leap there.
Well, you can't use the study, Mike, and just dismiss half of it. It's science is no good for you to proof text. Because hell, you don't even believe in DNA.
I believe in DNA.
No, because you can't be a believing Mormon believe in DNA. DNA alone will disprove Mormonism.
Why is that?
Oh, that's a topic for another day. We'll take it as an open challenge. Mike, I challenge you to come up to Salt Lake City and we'll argue whether or not you could be a Mormon and believe in DNA. All right. Well, Mike, any other last words?
It's good to be back.
It's good to be back.
Bruised and beat up, but
I'm sorry, Mike.
Maybe I'll do better next time.
No, you did perfectly fine. You're trying to defend an undefendable position, Mike.
It's defendable. I just like the studies and the memory skills.
Yeah, me too. All right. Well, as always, the discussion continues over on the website at MormonExpression.com, which I think is hacker-free for nearly 3 days these days. And you can also search out our Facebook group, the Mormon Expression Podcast Community, and stay tuned for other great, wonderful activities. Special thanks to the patience of our studio audience here tonight. We've had a lot of technical difficulties, and to Randy and Mike. Well, have a good night, everybody.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Mike.
Bye.